Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. Today on the show, we have a returning guest. We have part two of my conversation with Cara Cardone. Cara is a certified leadership coach with 20-plus years of experience. She lives in Northern California, and she survived multiple cult experiences, including joining ISTA, International School of Temple Arts, in 2021. After discovering reports of harm within ISTA, she co-founded 3SC, Safer Sex Positive and Spiritual Communities, which collected 50-plus harm reports and achieved some reforms in the group. Cara now facilitates survivor support groups and is launching a podcast. Today's episode will focus more on Cara's experiences with ISTA. So if you have not already heard the first episode with her from last week, please go back and listen. Here's part two of my conversation with Cara. It is my pleasure to have Cara Cardone back with us today. She's a fan favorite at the podcast, and in part because of how well you speak and put the thoughts together, but also because you've had different experiences that have led you sort of one experience into the next. And there's this interesting sequence to it that I think is really illuminating and also answers the question for a lot of people. Like, once I was involved in this, how come I got involved in something else or a relationship that felt like that? And what piece was I not getting from experience to experience about what to watch out for? Or what was I still searching for? What was I not noticing? I mean, it's all very interesting and it's all very human. And so I love that that's also woven in to what you talk about. So I would love for you to take a few moments and introduce yourself.
Thanks so much, Rachel. It's just amazing to be here. Part of the journey has really been finding my voice, especially about the latest chapter. So I'm Cara Cardone. I'm a leadership coach, and I've been a cult hopper. And so we talked about my history in the previous episode, which brought us up to the most recent group that I joined. And, you know, looking at what made me vulnerable at that point. So in this case, it had been, let's see, I had joined the Miracle of Love accidentally, as always, in around 2009. And so many years later, in 2021, at the kind of the breaking point of COVID, I had a breakup. So I'd had a COVID partner. It had been an unhealthy relationship. We broke up. And so in the beginning of 21, I was looking for healing. I was looking to develop my intimacy skills in particular. And I took a very solid online intimacy course, but someone in the chat mentioned this group called the International School of Temple Arts. And I followed the lead. I went to their website. It looked very exciting. They were combining shamanism, spirituality, and sexuality. So very spicy. And I saw that they were going to be doing a retreat. I'm in California. They were doing a retreat in Northern California. And so I sent the link to my best friend. She was like, let's do it. And squirreled away some money and signed up. So it's a week-long retreat called the Sexual Spiritual Shamanic Experience. and was held at a beautiful retreat center. Everyone was very welcoming. And, you know, I was thinking about when did the experience really start? And I noticed that once I signed up, we were added to a Facebook group just for people that were going to be on the retreat. And there was this, you know, invitation to introduce yourself. And I remember actually really struggling, like, how do I introduce myself in this space and looking at other people's introductions and already kind of feeling a sense of like, how do I fit in here? And kind of a little bit of pressure to define something. So didn't really clock that at the time, except, you know, in retrospect, being like, oh, I had some uncomfortable feelings. And having been primed by different new age kind of spiritual groups that, right, like lean into the discomfort. And if you're uncomfortable, then it's happening. And that they, you know, position discomfort as a sign of, yeah, of that you're in it and that you're doing it and that you're doing it right. So if you're too comfortable, maybe you're not working your edge. And so I showed up and we had a huge group. There were about 70 participants. And we circled for like the introductions. And there were three facilitators who sat on a couch at one end of the circle. And the rest of us were on pillows on the floor. And I thought to myself, oh, look, it's not a cult because there's three people on the couch and there isn't like a single leader. The man who had started it had already separated largely from the org. And so just tracking my faulty thinking, you know, at the time, the first evening was a lot about these agreements that we make. They were, in some cases, they're provided in advance in like a Google form, so you would have a chance to read them. In other, depending on the facilitator, sometimes they're just sprung on you in this circle. So you've paid, you've showed up, you've taken time off work. And among the agreements is the one about taking 100% responsibility for the nature of your experience. I imagine that one's not new to you.
Right, right. No, it's not. It's not. It's, you know, it comes in different kinds of language, but the message is the same. They absolve any kind of responsibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the other piece of information that was shared is that in this organization, they don't stop sexual interactions between teachers and students. And they explained that that was because out in the rest of the world, we have those rules, but those rules get broken. So instead of letting it happen in the shadow, let's put it on the table and then we will be doing this ethically because the other two teachers who are not going to engage sexually will get to weigh in on whether this is in the student's best interest. So this idea of a group gaze, making it safe because it's not just one person who's making the decision. It's a little embarrassing that that didn't raise more red flags. I kind of was like, that's interesting, that's weird, but I didn't think about it critically at the time. And I didn't really hear other people like criticize or question that.
You know, the way it's presented, I could see it not being something that would raise your suspicion or your worry, because it sounds like the message they're conveying is there's going to be oversight. There are going to be safeguards. This isn't something happening in the shadows where we can't kind of guarantee that it's going to be safe or healthy. And if it's done in a more public way and people are informed or knowledgeable of it, then it's going to be done in a way that is kind of healthier, and that it's nothing also to be ashamed of, I guess, because you're bringing it out into the public. I mean, there are a lot of messages there that do convey a kind of feeling that I could see would lower defenses and not raise them. But it's interesting, just as you were saying those words, when you say them now, I can see a look on your face like, oh, as I know that what I'm saying sounds okay, but it isn't. And you're almost sort of hearing what doesn't sound okay about it now. And I think also being involved in a new group, you want to be open. You want to be open to the ideas, open to all the possibilities, open to and in support of how this seems different from how it's done in other places, as though they've really thought this through and have found a way of approaching things that is more psychologically safe. At least that feels like the impression they're trying to give.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because it can be challenging not to look back at, you know, different points of the healing process with a lot of embarrassment and shame. And so, you know, being able to frame it as to like, well, in a lot of ways, that was a perfectly natural reaction to that situation, you know, and hindsight's always 20/20. So that keeping that in mind. So after the big circling, we went right into the, you know, these different practices. And so the first one was called Horse and Rider, and it was, we were broken into groups of three. The facilitators demonstrated, you know, the activity first often. So they would do transmissions or demonstrations. The idea was a conversation between your mind and your body. So your body is the horse and your mind is the rider. And there was an invitation, if you were comfortable, to take off your clothing during that practice. So the intensity right away of having your facilitators demonstrate it and get naked and be in, you know, this interesting conversation about what does our mind think and what does our body have to say about that. You know, like with so many of the exercises, especially my first time through, there were really interesting insights and the kind of connection that it starts to create between you and other participants, right? It's like a lot of intimacy very fast. So the next day, especially, there's a lot of introduction of emotional release tools. And there was a request in the circle that, you know, throughout this week that you use these tools. So when you're feeling upset, take one of these 7 or 8 tools, which were all very high energy. So hand screaming, pillow pounding, tantruming, wailing, like weeping, wailing, and having those introduced, like, I don't even know how long we went with practicing all of these. There was like really intense music, almost like a movie soundtrack crescendoing, very loud. Then the instructor, you know, on the microphone, guiding over that. And I remember it being just like so intense, and the sound in the room and the energy that I was creating, you know, within myself, that, and then breath work. So lots of things that just start kind of breaking you open and breaking you down, which is just a more vulnerable state to get into, right? And so this was like 7 days. So this is day 2, pretty much, the first whole day. And it was, for me, having had a number of experiences like this, in retrospect, I can see like, oh yeah, I really released a lot of chemicals that I like. I like getting really mystical and out there and high and I feel like, you know, it gives me permission to be bright and shiny and intense at things that I, you know, maybe struggle with in the day-to-day world. And so that sense of permission, like I really eat it up and I really lean in, and I end up being one of the loud people in the room, and noticing that in that state, I don't have access to critical thinking. And there's an encouragement to really be in the experience, get out of your mind, be in your body. And like so many of these techniques, I've learned that the fact that those are that's how we respond to these isn't really an issue. That's part of the human design, is that we can achieve these different states, you know, without even taking drugs, because we're creating it or generating it ourselves. The sticky part is that what's the programming that's put in at that point? And so, you know, both ISTA and the Miracle of Love had claimed they didn't have any dogma, or they don't have like the rule book or something to teach you. And yet, when you're in these open states, in those activities, there are ideas that are planted in there. And I think like the 100% responsibility gets drilled in different ways. We did an exercise with the drama triangle, which I found to be like very misleading, in that, you know, it talks about perpetrator, victim, and hero, and that we get stuck in playing one of those roles. And we often shift between them. And I think that we can recognize that it's the basis of a lot of drama. And we do at times get in there, but there's this ongoing devaluing of anything that sounds like victim. And that is, you know, perpetuated in there, that you can't, you know, that you're going to be in victim consciousness, where you're perpetuating the victim and making yourself the victim of yourself, right? And so the abuser disappears. There is no abuser. And then that's really dangerous, because there are abusers.
Because there are, right. Okay. So far from what you've said, it's fascinating already. So, right, there are no abusers, right? If there are no victims, there are no perpetrators. No one's done anything to you if you are fine. And you can say nothing's ever happened to me, or at least you're not allowed to say it or to feel it. When they say they don't have dogma, they don't have their own ideas or philosophies that they're kind of giving you, you're exactly right. They are. There are a lot of things that are being spoken, and there are a lot of things that are being done in an unspoken way that you just are not privy to at the time. Like, for example, if they are saying you're 100% responsible for your experience, and then they're also saying you're really not ever supposed to be the victim, they are giving themselves an out from the start, and making it okay for them to do whatever, and for you to not be able or allowed to have a negative reaction to it, and to then be able to talk about it and get any kind of support or even justice with it, which I know we're going to talk about. What's also interesting is that when people are given all of these things to do that are all high energy things, the unspoken message is, we want you in a highly activated state, that's the ideal. That's the way you're supposed to get things out. That's the way you're supposed to be, so that you can take in the experience. Like, if they really were offering you the ability to respond in a way that would be good spiritually, psychologically, they would probably give you a variety of things that you can do. So you can scream into your hands all the way to have quiet, meditation. Because that's sort of, that matches what would be feel right for you. But no, it's just all of this intensity that takes you into this other state where exactly as you're saying, that's a place where you're not going to have critical thinking. It's a place you're going to be so wound up. And the message is, this is how you're supposed to be. And this is also, I think, what you're supposed to push yourself to be. And we will also then be probably happy with you if we see you getting loud or writhing around, so you get positive reinforcement for being really kind of out of your body and out of control.
Yeah, I think that that's my experience. And I met, you know, there's so many lovely people that go to these events and even get sucked in deeper. One of the gentlemen I met, I remember he was just sitting in a meditative position, and the assistants kept going to him, and we talked about it later, and being like, "Hey, you're not doing it." And his point was, "Well, I've actually been to a number of these, and you know, I'm good." And that was not understood, not supported. You know, and for folks who have been tracking the ISTA story, and we'll get there, you know, there are some changes that have been made recently. So I understand there is the opportunity for more down regulation, that there is, you know, more opportunity to tap into what would be supportive for oneself. But unfortunately, I don't think that addresses the actual large group awareness training format. It is an LGAT with sex sprinkled in, so it's even spicier, you know, than your average LGAT. So the process just continues to be really intense and escalating. And one of the places, so there's a crescendo to a really intimate ritual that's like maybe the day before the last, and everything's kind of been accumulating to this activity called Sacred Spot. And ultimately it's like a G-spot massage, or it would be a prostate massage for the gentleman. And so people are paired randomly together to do this. So you pick a rock or a flower, and you're holding it. And when you turn around, so there's like two lines of people. When you turn around, you're going to figure out who has the same object that you have. And that's the person you're paired with. And I was incredibly anxious. I was super wound up. I had the attitude like I really wanted to do the activity in terms of I've come here, I'm all in, I want to do everything. But I felt very anxious that some of the men in particular there, that I would not feel safe. And I think I was then judging myself, right? That I'm like, oh, well, am I really open? And one of the female facilitators said around that point, "I want you to know that I would let any man here, I'd be honored for him to do this ritual with me." So blah, blah, blah. And I felt shamed and I felt angry. And in looking back at like, what are some of those messages? How was this communicated? When we're talking about coercive control or undue influence, right? That finding like, well, where are the things I could point to that indicate a worldview, how to be on the in crowd, how to do it right, which was, hey, ladies, any guy you get is a good guy. And not saying, you know, be in consent with yourself, or, you know, those things were said, but it's like they end up being like lip service because you're getting these mixed messages.
Right. Wow. I just wanted to say something about that, which is, as you were telling that story of having this ceremony, which you may or may not have been informed about ahead of time. Probably not. Right. And I'm guessing, right? that I was feeling your anxiety, just that here you're going to pick an object and that that is going to set you up, really set you up with someone else and set you up in a situation where you're going to have this feeling like you gave your consent, but you didn't. And you're not going to realize that you didn't give your consent for this. But a lot of people think, well, I signed up and I need to be open and this is the pinnacle and I will have wasted all this time leading up to this moment. And so as though all of that leads to you saying, well, here I am, so I need to be okay with this and I need to say yes. But you don't, just like in the world outside, if someone said, you know, hey, we drive the same car, that means that I can have sex with you. No, it does not. So, but there, because you picked the same thing, suddenly you need to have, you need to give someone access to your body and they need to have or allow access to theirs. And that is way beyond what you signed up for, but still probably within this social pressure of needing to feel like you have to go along with it. And already, as you're saying, looking down on yourself for having a very natural and appropriate reaction to this moment.
Yeah. So my best friend was there. She's in a monogamous relationship, had chosen to sit out a number of things. She had told the facilitation that she wasn't going to be in. I guess they had forgotten or not heard her. And so when it came time, because they need to pair people up, there was an interaction where they were like, well, you need to do it because you're messing up our numbers. And she was like, well, you're going to have to fix that some other way. But hearing about that after the fact and like, wow, really? That's not of the highest integrity. Consent, you know, and consent is, you know, how do you consent to attending a mystery school? And, you know, I've come to say, like, you could consent to, like, skydiving with its known risks, and you could check out, you know, have there been injuries or, you know, what's the reputation as far as skydiving? I think that would be a more honest comparison than, as their site said, it is for everyone. I think it probably still says that, though they would say that's not their position now, that you would need to be not everybody. So yeah, there's all of these messages, both covert and overt, that happen in the space. And it's interesting because, like with Sacred Spot, I've talked to other practitioners, and one of them said, you know, Sacred Spot is wherever you say it is. If we were doing that in integrity, you could be like sitting at my feet. That's my sacred spot today. Versus this idea of that sacred spot is within our bodies, you know, intimate places. So. And that it's not characterized as a sexual act. It is a spiritual ritual. And so I think that language is really interesting as to how that skews one's sense of participation or consent as well.
What I am wondering about is how your friend was treated for really saying no. And what happened to her after that, and what she was maybe told about herself. And so I'm curious about that. We don't have to get into that now, or if you don't want to at all, that's fine. But I'm just wondering what saying no does to you in this group.
You know, in her case, I think that age plays a role as being in her 60s. I don't think there was as much pressure or influence or kind of attention paid from saying no, based on reports from survivors of harm. I've heard of many really problematic responses to saying no. Yeah, so she didn't really face that, because it's interesting. There's like evening, they call them temple nights, of non-facilitated interaction, kind of like a dance party slash cuddle puddle, all the way up to more of a sex party if you stay longer and go up in levels. And there was a really interesting dynamic, this idea that, you know, you're 100% responsible for your experience, and being with people who were less attractive, people who were more awkward, and really how shaming it became to try to even enter that space, because it was like, you know, unless you can insert yourself, or unless you can initiate, or unless, you know, whatever you're feeling is your fault, whatever you're feeling, you know, it's uncomfortable is your own problem. And the denial of, you know, the beauty standards of the insider circle of the extrovert, right? Like, you know, you're attracting all of these people who are coming from healing all the way to predators who see this as a hunting ground for naive, vulnerable people. And it was just a different kind of harm that I recognized afterwards, and that I've heard from people, and especially, you know, some of like the awkward and vulnerable men. I would say that's actually where they received more shame and more discomfort from.
Oh, wow.
A lack of inclusivity, a lack of desirability.
Huh. Interesting. Wow. Okay. Very interesting. So, okay. Thank you for that. And I'm always curious about the outliers, what happens to them when they don't exactly fit in. But it's also an interesting thing between extroverts and introverts and how they're treated. And especially if you're supposed to get loud and primal, that is much more of an extroverted comfort zone. So that is very interesting. So, okay, so coming back to this moment, the sacred spot. So here you were, and I'm wondering about this experience, even just psychologically.
Yeah, I was really stressed. And when I turned around, I'd actually matched or paired with a really lovely young man who we had some interactions. We'd talked, he'd been very friendly. And so I felt super grateful. You know, one wonders about that release of stress, right? In terms of the tension, and then being like, oh, you know, he really is this lovely young person and is really here with a pure heart. He's not someone that took any more levels of ISTA. There's a lot of people, the majority of people, I think, only go once, and a lot of them leave, I think, just with a mixed bag, right? Of having had some intense experiences and connections, but also these levels of harm. But so for me in that moment, I was all in. I was like, let's do this. And he was super sweet and supportive. And, you know, I don't know what, in terms of the spiritual crossover, something I think about is like, how does that create kind of an altered state? Like, I went on a vision quest and I saw all kinds of images and had, you know, what felt like a really beautiful spiritual experience. And holding that along with the problems, I think, is what I notice a lot of people who are still in the organization struggle with, is, you know, but there's a lot of I got mine-ism. Well, it worked for me and I didn't get hurt and I didn't see any harm. But I think that for some of us, it's that we don't know how to hold that both good and bad things happened. And we don't want to throw away the good thing, because they feel precious, and also we've invested in them, and, you know, we've gone places to get them. And so that desire to protect or defend or hold on to them, I see as an ongoing issue and problem as the more reports of harm come out.
I think about that experience for you and how lucky you were to just happen to be paired with someone you felt comfortable with, and then you could go somewhere else in your mind and have an experience that felt safe. And I'm sure that was not the case for everyone. And there were probably some people who you were dreading being paired with. And so I wonder in those moments if you get to say no, if someone really does alarm you, you know?
Absolutely. So one woman, I think in her late 40s or early 50s that I met there, so someone with really good established boundaries and a lot of practice in sex positive and cuddle spaces, she had her partner massage her feet. That was the extent of it. And I think she felt good. Now, I don't know that I saw any women in their 20s not participating. And in subsequent rituals I attended, occasionally there would be a couple of women that would choose to sit out of the circle. And so it's not, especially with level one and you have a lot of new people, I wouldn't say, you know, you're dropped into a super intense, overt pressure in that way.
Okay. Okay. So, and knowing that this is level one, it's already, you know, a lot. So I'm getting a sense that if it gets way more intense than this, it would, yes, illuminate us, show us what that's like.
So one of the other activities in level one is we're circling every day and there's like a hot seat kind of opportunity. And so people aren't called on, but it's you're invited to jump into the center and share some insight or breakthrough. And I remember one of the other facilitators who was there kept encouraging me like to get the most out of this experience. Plan to get in there. And that facilitator also was telling me, you know, like, oh, you're special, you're a leader, and we'd love to see more of you. And I, at the end of level one, signed up for my next session as an assistant with that facilitator. Luckily, I did some research on the other facilitators, and one of them was so toxic and problematic that I chose not to attend. So I kind of outstepped that. And that was a thing with ISTA. They call themselves an organism, not an organization. And they were kind of, you know, like, we're all sovereign beings and we don't have a structure. And so word on the street was like, look up your facilitators because they're not all equal, which I called them on as being incredibly unfair because as a newcomer, like you might not know about that, right? You're trusting them that they're an organization with integrity and you should be able to be safe no matter who's leading it. But that was kind of a way of shirking responsibility that still goes on. So then I went back still 6 months later as an assistant for level one. And so that means you pay a little bit less, but you work really, really hard. And things I noted that I hadn't seen as just a straight participant was there was just always the sense of urgency. We didn't have enough time. Do, you know, be effective, but take care of yourself. Switch the room up, switch the room again. So there was this pace and this intensity about time control. And there was assistants would lead smaller groups so that people have, you know, out of 50 participants, you have a group of five or six led by an assistant that meet each day. And as assistants, we're keeping an eye on the well-being of our pod. So then we go back to the larger facilitator group and we would basically report out on, you know, are people a green flag? It's all good. Is there a yellow flag? Is there a red flag? Does someone need immediate support? And what was interesting is I had gotten really impatient with one of the men in my pod, an older gentleman, and he was spending a lot of time talking about how things should be done differently. Interestingly enough, that's what I shut him down about. A little moral injury there. I have apologized. And I made a comment of like, you know, get out of your head and into your heart. Like, stop telling everybody how to fix things and get in your own lane. And I had said it in some clever way, and I reported that back out to the group. I got so much positive reinforcement for that. It was noticeable. It brought laughs. It was, look at Kara. She's not even been around that long, and she's got it going on. And, you know, it's part of where I think that organizations like this ultimately, a big part of the harm is that they teach narcissism. They teach be less empathetic, whether it's dark feedback, working on your shadow, being responsible for your experience, letting people have their own experience. So there was an agreement, you know, if someone's crying, don't interrupt them, don't offer them tissue. If you need something, you should ask for it. It sounds very reasonable. And there are situations where you're like, yeah, sometimes someone's crying and we're not trying to help them. We're trying to shut them down because we're not comfortable with crying. Sure. However, when you set as a foundation not to respond and act empathetically, not to help people who are struggling, not to gossip or talk about things, right? Like this idea of, you know, you should go directly to the person and speak directly to them. Again, it's not that it's wrong. It's that each of these things can be well used and misused. And there's no transparency about, hey, these are the guardrails. There's two sides. And we want you to operate in here. And so it all becomes part of really an indoctrination and a perpetuation. As I've seen, you know, people I started with who carried on, and it was like watching the light go out as they become more empowered and, you know, and more superior in their spirituality.
Wow. And that is, it seems so contradictory, because if you think that someone is getting higher in their spiritual development, that the light is going on. That, right, they're able to be more receptive and attuned and connected and not disconnected, not cold, not seemingly uncaring. And it could be, like you're talking about the moral injury, that there were people who didn't feel quite right, not going over to someone who's crying or not offering them a shoulder or a tissue. When you're told that it is to help someone, that you need to leave them alone, then you think you're being benevolent, right? It's very interesting. And a lot of cultic groups have that as their philosophy. Don't interfere. If someone gets injured, let them take care of themselves. Don't get in the way of that. And I, you know, fine, I guess it's presented as this empowering stance for the other. But I have to assume, because so many of these things that are codified in these groups are set up as such because it's how the leader thinks and what the leader thinks is an ideal, but also what the person who developed the group, and sometimes it's still who the leader is to that day, what they're capable of and what naturally occurs for them. And I think of people like the L. Ron Hubbards of the world who didn't have compassion, who wouldn't think to go over to someone who was injured or hurt and, you know, well, that's on them. Even though I'm sure if he had something wrong with him, he would want a lot of attention. But so it usually it just goes in one direction. But that is really very interesting. So that there was more coldness and that they were teaching narcissistic traits as the ideal. That's really fascinating. Very, very interesting. Okay.
They have roots in Landmark, in Osho, Rajneesh as well. You know, there's a large community. It came out of California, was in Sedona in its early days. I mean, there's so much history that one can get into about the origins. But we see those perpetuation of what I think are those really dangerous thought forms that have continued, you know, from abusive organization to abusive organization. And so at the end of assisting, there was a feedback session for the facilitators. So as assistants, we had 5 minutes to both share a learning, provide praise, provide feedback, and also receive feedback. So I was like, whoa, that's a lot. So you had to prioritize how you wanted to spend your time. There was pressure. The sooner we get this done, the sooner we can clean up and get out of here. And I had this moment where I was like, oh, if I'm sovereign and I'm empowered, then I should not be fearful to tell the truth about a number of things that I clocked that were problematic, and especially one where I had done the demonstration in front of the whole group of Sacred Spot with one of the facilitators. It's very intimate, very intense, and I had not received care afterwards, where I wanted to, like, let's sit down and process this. And I got blown off and then kind of forgotten. Also, you had to determine how intense of a feedback do you want. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how much can you handle? So all of these things that, you know, I noticed a lot of things brought up for me the desire to prove myself.
I was going to say, right? Like me having to say what you can handle, I could imagine just saying, okay, well, I'm going to just let them know I can handle anything. Yeah.
Here right. for it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I said, yeah, give me a 10 and here's my feedback. You know, this didn't look good and felt like you missed the boat here. And then, you know, I did this ritual and there was no care and I got ignored. And the room went quiet and the lead facilitator turned around and said, I call bullshit. See how your victim mentality is here making us into the offender when really it's about you taking responsibility for your life. And I'm sure there's other places in your life where this is a real problem. So I hope you go home and explore where your lack of responsibility and sovereignty is undermining the things you say you care about, something along those lines. And then was like, yeah, weren't you even supposed to do this job as an assistant and you didn't even do a good job over here? So it ended with that jab. And I just took it like a punch. I felt proud of myself for taking a punch. I went into fawning of thank you so much for being, you know, giving me this loving feedback. I left with that attitude that, you know, I was at fault and people in my life, when I told them, you know, I'm at fault, I'm this, and they were like, something's off here. And I was like, oh, you weren't there. You don't know. And I dismissed, you know, the people that knew me best. So I signed up for level 2. That is, you need permission in order to go into level 2. So there's a little, again, proving and insider stuff. It is the sexual, spiritual, shamanic initiation. They talk about it being level 1 being very like personal stuff and level 2 is transpersonal. So we're working with the energies that are bigger than us versus our personal story. And it begins where you give up your name and you are assigned a name. There's 2 baskets that go around. And so you pick an adjective and an object. I was Dangerous Flea, FLEA.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the facilitators was Irrelevant Chlamydia.
Wow. Okay.
So that there's, you know, this, again, breaking down of identity. You don't have your name. No one knows your name. You are, you know, these assumed names. And it's focused a lot on, you know, like a death and rebirth process. And so there's a lot of ritual of like, let's, you know, be decapitated spiritually, ritualistically. So we're no longer using our mind. We're cutting our hearts out. So it's no longer our individual heart. We're open to this universal or greater love. And they announced on like day three that there was going to be the slaughtering of an animal. In my case, it was a rabbit. And that this was about proving, especially as Westerners were so disconnected from the consumption of meat, even though we all eat it, and did we basically have the guts to look at the guts? And there was a vegan in my group who lost her mind. Like, she was livid. And the facilitator really just poo-pooed her and said, well, you don't have to do it. And you can, like, and taking no responsibility for the fact that had she known that anything like that happened, she never would have given her money. She never would have been there. So the lack of informed consent, you know, around that was really intense for her in particular. For me, I was like, oh, I eat meat and I'm that doesn't particularly scare me. But in retrospect, given the amount of ritual and spiritual content and that we're going into the underworld and we didn't really invoke any kind of protection or safety or white light or goodness, I really saw it as a double agenda, which was look over here while we talk about your incapacity to deal with meat, but we're also doing what could be called a blood ritual. And that for me was like a major spiritual injury that crossed all kinds of lines for me that I didn't see until retrospect.
My goodness, this is so disturbing and, you know, shocking for people, I'm sure, even listening to this, not knowing that it was going to go in this direction. It feels like a needle scratch on a record. What was that? Quick question from your story before and then coming back to this sacrifice. The names that you needed to pick out, the noun and the adjectives, who came up with those words? Was it those the leaders or those the participants?
It was probably the assistants and the facilitators. I don't recall like writing anything or putting it in. I just remember them coming around from the leadership.
So the thing that's interesting is that of the names that you mentioned, they're critical, they're put downs, they are criticisms, they are lowly things. And so often, I mean, yes, it is not a good sign when a group wants you to give up your identity and take on another name. But usually you choose, you really choose the name that speaks to you, the one that maybe that you aspire to be like, the one that you really identify with. You don't have somebody else decide who you are, especially in the negative, in that you have to sort of walk around being that or making up for being that. In some ways, I mean, it's very toxic in so many ways. And then leading up to this, that somehow in this spiritual group, when you're talking about the coldness, that there is going to be an innocent thing that is murdered so that they can help you achieve something in your life. I don't understand the connection at all, but it is pretty brutal and cold and heartless. And very interesting. And also knowing that you went into level two after having been tremendously criticized for being open and honest about how you felt and needing to be appreciative of being treated that way. So you're being set up to be in that kind of emotionally subservient place and needing to go along with things, especially things that are really uncomfortable, thinking it's for your benefit. I just see all of the control mechanisms in play. It's really, really disturbing. Okay, so back to, unfortunately, the idea of killing an animal.
Yeah, so that happened, and I understand it different locations. Sometimes it might be like a cow heart, or it might not be a living animal. I don't know if they're continuing to do it now that the word's getting out about it. So that would be great if they stopped. And so level two culminates in a really intense peak ritual. And I had a couple of experiences throughout all three where I dissociated. One in particular where I started to panic because while I was aware of my body, my mental state was somewhere else in an arid desert. And I was trying to like dance and get myself back in my body. And I had a couple of those experiences through the course of you know, these activities that were pretty disturbing and would tie into other people who, when I left and found out about lots of people who've been harmed, one of the outcomes has been psychotic breaks. So in the New York Magazine article that came out about ISTA recently, there's an account of a gal and someone I've spoken with who left, her parents picked her up and took her to a psychiatric facility. And she's, you know, experienced ongoing harm from having hit that kind of psychiatric necessity. So there's, you know, the fallout as far as the LGAT format and people becoming hypomanic, manic, and even psychotic. And then there's the sexual assault, sexual abuse, and rape issues with the organization. So after level two, I was planning on going back and assisting again. So I was kind of on a 6-month re-up process, in part because they came to my area of the world. They have retreats all over the world, like 58 a year. Still going on, haven't slowed him down yet. And I saw a Facebook post by one of the facilitators, actually the one who had been so harsh with me. And it was very confusing, but they mentioned that there was a group on Facebook called Issues with ISTA and Haydn. Haydn's a entwined but separate cult set in New Zealand. And I asked to join the group. I was among the first 100 who went in. And there were accounts of sexual assault, rape, victim blaming that went back over 10 years. And I had gone in thinking, oh, well, I'll learn what the problems are and I'll be a bridge and I'll go back and I'll make it better. Just real pure-hearted. And I found out like, whoa, this is so much bigger than I thought. And then the aha moment was when I shared about the feedback circle and I explained, you know, the response and someone said, oh, that's Darvo. That facilitator defended herself and then she attacked you and then she reversed victim and offender. And that was like the aha moment. And I said, well, I wasn't sexually assaulted, but I was absolutely injured by that. And for me, that was like a real breaking point personally, because that's when I recognized, oh no, not again. I had thought this was the opposite side of the spectrum. This was a dream come true. This was healing the world through reducing sexual shame, increasing connection, you know, things that I really admired and believe in and wish for, but also very naively, you know, discounting the potential for harm, the misuse of power, perpetuation of these harmful, you know, systems, this idea of like female spiritual empowerment, but really the perpetuation of misogyny and patriarchy. So it was like, oh no, my dream is a nightmare. And I dropped out of the coaching program that I was enrolled in. I became obsessive with both the Facebook group and doing research. I went into a severe depression and finally got a therapist and actually went on antidepressants. And through being part of the EWE group, I got invited to participate in leadership. I had written one post that was like, here's 21 things they could do to be better. And it's interesting in the survivor group because there were people who were like, they can't change, they can't be better, don't even go there. And I was like, well, this is how my brain works. This is how I'm learning or processing. But it also positioned me to be part of this group, ultimately called Safer Sex Positive and Spiritual Communities, or 3SC. Had a group of about 5-6 activists, some who had attended ISTA, many who had not, but had been dealing with the fallout for years in terms of friends and community members who were injured, and seeing the perpetuation of the facilitators into other facilitators, right? Like they're teaching this and it's spreading. And that being a concern for people in safe or in sex positive communities. So we put up a Google form and collected reports of harm. And we received over 50. Some of them were completely confidential. They just wanted someone to hear and hold their story. Others said you can, you know, use us in data analysis. Some even said you can send this report over to ISTA or their mediation group. And we took those, created a big report and a letter of a long list of recommended changes, including pulling the top three offending facilitators who had the most harms recorded against them, to pull them out of teaching and do at least some kind of an accountability process. And of course, the recommendation that you no longer allow sex between facilitators and students. But then a whole bunch of other things, like looking at, you know, the cultural appropriation going on, looking at of ultimately the large group awareness training format. I didn't really have that language when we first approached them. That's been part of my healing and education. And so we managed to kind of leverage that into facilitated talks. Four of their leaders met with a paid mediator that we chose, but they paid for, who actually did quite a bit of voluntary work. Like the amount of work this person put in was beyond what they got paid by far. And so we thought it was going to be like 3 months of talks, and it went over a year. And part of that was there was a lot to unpack, but these facilitators are traveling around the world, continuing to do their trainings, even though we recommended that they stop and take account of where they were at. That did not fly. So, you know, it took longer because of their scheduling challenges and frankly, not prioritizing it and not feeling as urgent as we did. We also prioritized, like, what can you stop or fix to prevent future harms? It's much harder to get them to focus on the existing harms and how can they do something to repair those relationships or make them better by giving people their money back or covering therapy or covering group therapy. And they never really reached that. They did put in a process where they put mediators in place. But if you request your money back, as I did for one of my trainings, they ask you to sign an NDA with a non-disparagement clause. That's also in the New York magazine article that happened to a survivor of rape, articulated in the article. With the reports that we got, the majority had to do with coercion, boundary crossing. There were not specific accounts that were like criminal that we could have leveraged to make it, you know, more involved criminally. And so we really were trying to do like a restorative justice or a transformative justice approach. And it was excruciating for me, just sitting across from folks and trying to pop the bubble of denial. There were moments where I could see that there was an impact and that there was a shift at moments, but it felt like trying to go through 1,000 veils and maybe a couple of them come down, you know? They did pull the 3 facilitators. They did change the sexual protocols, at least for level 1, maybe for level 2, I don't know. But they don't provide those sexual protocols to participants. I just had someone who reached out to me who had gone just a few months ago and was asking, hey, is there a document? Because I'm still unclear about what is and isn't permissible. And so there's ongoing problems and confusion. We celebrated in a joint statement as an activist group that they had taken those 2 steps. There was a marathon ahead. And as far as from the outside, it does not look good. They built an accountability system that, in my experience and feedback I'm getting from other survivors, doesn't work. They've coddled and wrapped the harm doers in coaching and classes and, oh, we're gonna, you know, transform them and protect them. And it's been really painful. Like I didn't think that probably we could get them to change entirely, but I really wanted to show up at the table to say, if this is the leading organization in this space, they're worldwide, if they want to improve consent and boundaries, and we can help them turn the car around. One analogy as activists we used was, you're in a car headed for a cliff, running along you going, hey, turn the wheel, you're headed for a cliff. And, you know, they've said things like, well, feedback is a gift, but it's not really, you know, long story short, I invested these 2 years in doing mediation, in supporting survivors behind the scenes, and it culminated in this New York Magazine article coming out about a rape. But beyond the article, what was the death knell for me was their response to the article and their choices of the things they responded to, the things they didn't respond to, the victim blaming. That just broke me. I was like, we did not change how they think. We got them to do a couple things, but it didn't change how they think. And then that was highlighted in the latest accountability report that they have every 6 months. They'll post, like, here we are in the accountability process. This is what we're working on. And the last one ended with, we've been made aware of the harms that the abusers are suffering by being in accountability because they're not working and they have reputational damage and they're harmed because the community will often gossip and distort. So that broke me. I was like, oh, they're in charge. They're in charge. They're warping the language. They are doing the victim over and over. And so seeing the harmers do the victim over and over. So I reached out to one of my last contacts inside ISTA, who's a leader. And I just made an impassioned plea where I just said, hey, this, I don't know if you wrote the response. It doesn't look good. It's really devastating. If you guys are leaders in consent and boundaries, you can't justify what's happened here. But if you've turned the ship around, this is your chance to really demonstrate it. And the response I got was, you don't have permission to talk to me in this tone.
Wow. Okay.
So it ended with Darvo.
Yeah. It's so disappointing. It's more than disappointing. It just shows that there isn't an interest in establishing safeguards. And I think also in being an adult about it and just saying, you're right. So sorry. We have learned. We may or may not fully understand what you're saying and why it's wrong, because we kind of like doing it the way we were doing it and not having to take responsibility. But we can see, I mean, it's even okay if they have, you know, they say we're not willing to fully learn, but still, we need to change because we don't want to harm people in an effort to help them. And we don't want to traumatize them. And we don't want to put them in the hospital. Clearly, something is wrong here. And whether or not we fully understand it, we need to change it. And we will. And that would be grown up.
Well, and I mean, I think that they would say, well, that's what we've done, Rachel. We have put all these safeguards in place and we have changed. Yet from the weaponizing of consent, I've had that you don't have consent to give me bad feedback, which is just so twisted. And then there's the use of power. So the power dynamics were something they all were like, oh, we just missed out on the problems, but now we've all done trainings and power dynamics. And so we're going to be leaders in the ethical power space. There's so much hubris and such a lack of humility.
Such a lack. Oh, it's so sad. I know we're finishing up and we're about done with time, but I think even the language here that you had to sign a non-disparagement clause. So, I mean, that's also another red flag when you are not free to really be open and to really share. But I also think just the word disparagement, because when people are told that they're being critical or they're being attacking or they're being abusive in their language just because someone else doesn't want to hear it, they're also sometimes told that when they're just stating facts, they are disparaging. When they're just stating facts, they're being critical. But all they're doing is stating facts. You're just saying, this is what happened. This is what can happen. Those are facts. But if it is termed under disparagement or criticism and all of that, then it lets you know already that they're going to see it through that lens, that it's something about the person who's saying it that is suspect here, that they might have something to gain by it, or they're being negative, or they're playing the victim card as opposed to just saying what is true. That is really interesting. That's very disappointing.
Yeah, a lot of critics of us even attempting the process kind of are like, we told you so. But I gotta say, I'm really proud of us for running the experiment, and we came to the same conclusion, but I didn't jump to that conclusion. I actually invested so much love and care, emotional labor in, and I believe that there are some people that will have been positively influenced by that. Now it's also about protecting people before they get in there.
Yeah, right. Which is makes these kinds of podcast episodes very important for education, for prevention. But also the way you approach this is so commendable. Just really taking this seriously, wanting to give an organization or an organism, whatever they want to call themselves, an opportunity. You know, here it almost feel like you're being the parent saying, okay, kids, here we go. There's a chance for you to grow, to see, to learn. Let me help you. And then it's for them to take advantage of the opportunity or not. But I love the way you approached it, which really is, you know, which is commendable. And I'm so sorry that it is still going to be a place that is not going to have the safeguards, even though now they, even more so than before, think they do. And they might be able to say they do, but they don't. So thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for what you shared with us today, for the work that you have been doing to try to keep people safer, or at least being able to make more of an informed decision before getting involved, which is sometimes all you can do and the best thing to do. So thank you so much, Cara. And where can people find the article or anything else that you would like them to be able to find?
Sure. So we have the activist site is 3, the number 3, or spelled out, sc.community. You can also find it on a link, I believe, on my coaching website, caracordonicoaching.com. I'm not super active on the socials, just a little bit, but those are two spots you can get updates from me.
Okay. Oh, wonderful. Good. Good to see you. Good to talk to you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And keep us posted on what's been happening and hope to talk to you about it again.
There'll definitely be more to talk about in the future. So thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
My pleasure. One more thing before you go. Thank you so much for being with us today and listening to my conversation with Cara. The first part of the conversation is in a previous episode, so please check it out. This part two of the conversation is so enlightened and enlightening. It is so important to be able to hear Cara talking about how much she was pushed to be in so many uncomfortable situations. Uncomfortable and to the point of really being put in harm's way emotionally. I think when you have a group that really wants you to not put any barriers up to being put in a bad situation, they will often try to get you to feel like your discomfort is for your benefit. The thing that pushes you out of your comfort zone is the only thing that's really going to get you to the goal that you want. But I've talked on the podcast before about how the idea of no pain, no gain, I think, is doing a disservice to people because you actually don't need to feel pain in order to have a gain. You don't have to be pushed. You don't have to allow yourself to do something that feels contrary to what feels right in your core in order to grow, in order to learn. But here in organizations like ISTA, you are supposed to lean into the discomfort. You're supposed to not have it register as something bad. You're supposed to see it as a benefit and, I guess then, even have gratitude for it. Yeah, if you are wanting to make sure that you are building new muscles and you're going to go to the gym or you're going to hike or you're going to do something to build that new muscle, then yes, that might cause you some pain, but that's your choice. And that's what you want to develop. That's not someone else telling you what direction you're supposed to go in, what muscle group you're supposed to be working on today. Cults will tell you that. They won't let you be in charge of your own ship, of your own path. They won't let you hold the reins. They will, again, push you and pull you. And then go back to this idea that I was talking about after the first part of the episode with Cara, that somehow if they're taking you along a certain path, it's because they know you better than you know yourself, and they know what direction you're supposed to go in better than somehow you know, which is usually a falsehood and usually just a way to have you stop listening to the voice inside of you and hear theirs louder than yours, which is where you have sometimes a recipe for disaster. Because these are people who don't necessarily have your best interest in mind. They have their own best interest and their own ego needs much more in mind than what's best for you. There's also something that Cara talked about needing to sign a non-disparagement clause. And when cultic groups, when businesses, when partners want you or need you or tell you you have to sign a non-disparagement clause, I find this all very disturbing. First, you always want to notice that if you're getting involved in something and they're handing you lots of forms to sign, where you don't have a chance to have an attorney look at them first, but you're being pushed to sign them on the spot, do not sign them on the spot. If they are going to have your signature on them, there is the chance that they're going to be legally binding. They might not always be, and that's something you want to find out about. But just in case they're going to become legally binding, always have an attorney look at it first, and not the group's attorney, your own. The other thing is about the word disparagement. Disparagement is a word that has a really negative connotation. And so I think within a lot of groups, within controlling partners, they will see anything that is a criticism as you disparaging them, as you bringing up an insult that is for the purpose of making them look bad. But that comes, I think, from the narcissistic mind. That's how narcissists feel about anything you're going to say that might just be you stating a fact. Like, I don't like when you yell at me all the time. It makes me feel bad. They can say, stop insulting me. They can say, stop disparaging me. Stop making me look bad in public. But all you're doing is you're stating what you need there to change in order for you to feel safe and happy. And so, what is disparagement? Is it that when people come out of these groups, when they're talking about having been barred from being able to say no, when they're told in some other groups about how starving yourself or not taking the medication that you need or going days without sleep is somehow to build your internal strength. And then you want to tell people about that so that they understand why it looks like you are absolutely falling apart inside and out. Are you disparaging the group or are you just saying what's true? Stating a fact isn't the same as disparaging. Stating a fact isn't the same as insulting. Stating a fact isn't the same as being negative. It isn't the same as having the devil inside you or whatever the insult is that the group would actually levy on you just by virtue of you saying what's true. If someone can't handle it and they don't want to hear it, they will say that you're doing something wrong. They will say that you are being insulting. They'll say that you're trying to do something to ruin their reputation. But I've often thought that if people who mistreat you are so worried about their reputation and how they're seen in public and how they're talked about in public, then why aren't they just more careful about treating people kindly, treating people fairly? And not putting them in harm's way, and not putting them in danger, not making them feel scared, not making them feel in a weakened state. I think that if they are worried about how they're being talked about, they needed to be more careful about how they treated you. Take good care. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon. At patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings. Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King. Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.